updating you wherever you may be. We're here with Scott, with Kirk, and myself, Craig, in another episode of Observations. We have devoted this program, as we have our Yada Yada Radio, the Shabbat Torah study, which will commence again this evening at 7:30 Eastern Time, 4:30 Pacific Time, on Friday evenings on Yada Yada Radio. We've been focused on what God had to say about religion and politics, patriotism and governance, and the book of Samuel, Samuel. He listens to God. And we've been, I think we began in the seventh chapter and spent a number of programs just on one passage, 7:3, and the insights that are provided to us therein. And then all the way through the eighth chapter of Samuel. And what we came to learn is that when it comes to government and religion, God has been crystal clear that to engage in a relationship with God, we must first reject religion, and we have to distance ourselves from government. Those who choose government reject God. So, Kirk, what we wanted to do today is just finish that discourse, because just because there is a chapter break and we have concluded everything God had to say about government, which was incredible. I mean, it's just how they were going to, the government leaders would be self-serving. They would, the first thing they would do to ensure that they remained in power is they would build a military. They would take draft sons, steal sons from families to become the troops within that military. Then they would rob the people of their productivity to build the weapons that would be deployed and by that military. And then they would use the military. They'd deploy it. They'd go to war. Mm-hmm. And that would be the primary trait of governments. But he also said, you know, and beyond all that, they're going to tax you blind. They're going to do everything imaginable that is counterproductive to you. And even to the place where the women are going to be used to make drugs for you.
Right.
And so it all comes out at the end after saying that, you know, they're going to rob the productive and make and to enrich the leader and his cronies. God says, if you're going to choose government, you're choosing to reject me. He says, but I'm going to do everything I can to warn you about it.
You know, you say something in another chapter of Observations, your new book on Observations, that I thought was extraordinarily insightful. When you talk about how it is our participation in making a pledge and joining the group that does mm-hmm. that gives them all the power. I mean, it seems a given that that's the case, but I don't think people realize when you join them, pledge allegiance, do all those things, mm-hmm. that strengthens them and gives them the very power to do all these things. He has no army if the army walks away.
Correct.
He has no. If you don't pay the tax, he can't take it. You know, unless he has an army to take it from.
Yeah. Yeah. God does not look at religion, religion and governance and the military as victimless crimes. And he goes so far to say that the very participation of masses of people in religions and in militaries and in political schemes is what gives them credibility. Yeah. It's what fuels them. And so he is extremely antagonistic towards those who choose to be religious. He says, you're not a victim. You've actually empowered the institution. In fact, we're going to return to Proverbs 6, which is where we began this program, largely because I was eager to answer a friend's email question about who the whore was in Proverbs 6. And so I did a very quick translation, but didn't do the in-depth commentary. And I've subsequently finished now the first three chapters of the book called Observations, and we're going to return there, which is where God says this very thing, that you are not going to be considered acceptable because you use the excuse of having been victimized by religion and politics. because you contributed to it.
That's my fault. Everyone did it.
Yeah, yeah. And by everyone doing it, you made it credible. So now that we have had God's take on government, which is the antithesis of Paul's. Now, that's one of the things that I've had a conversation with somebody today and again yesterday about this, that when you compare what Paul said to what God said on every subject, they're the opposite. Paul's premise on government, speaking of the Roman government, is that it was put there by God. You should submit to it. It never wields the sword for anything other than good. God's perspective on government generally, and Rome specifically, is that it is corrupt. It is, you should distance yourself from it. You should disassociate yourself from it. You should never submit to it. And that it wields its sword viciously and cruelly. And that he views it as an abomination. So now that we know all of that, the thing that we had not finished was the identity, the name of, and the place from which he came, of the specific individual that God was associating with human governance. And that man's name is presented to us in the opening statements of Samuel, 1 Samuel 9. So let's begin with what it says, God always sets the context. God doesn't just say, hey, the guy's name was Shaul, and you take it or leave it. It's not important that you know his name, but I'm going to say his name anyway, but his name is Shaul. Don't bother to think about it. No, it's not the way God operates. He's going to give you all sorts of insights that help you understand. So this begins. Now, there was an individual of, could have been any one of the 12 tribes, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, was it?
No.
It was of a very specific tribe. Same tribe that the wannabe self-proclaimed apostle Paul claimed to be from. From the tribe that Yahweh says is a vicious wolf. It's from the tribe that was the most ruthless against, of all places, Yahudah. Now, there was an individual from Benjamin. Benjamin. Now, Benjamin, if you ask a person who has some knowledge of Hebrew, will tell you it means son of the right hand.
Son of the right hand.
Ben is clearly son in Hebrew. No argument there. But is Yad or Yam the Hebrew word for hand?
Yod.
Yod. Hmm. In fact, Yod is the first letter in Yahweh's name. If you're going to look for a Yod and try to understand hand, isn't the letter Yod drawn as a hand?
Yes, sir.
So is there any question in the world that Yod is the Hebrew word for hand?
None whatsoever.
Yam is a very common Hebrew word, isn't it? In fact, Yamin, in the plural, is written hundreds upon hundreds of times in the Torah. What does it mean?
I'm sorry.
Yam.
Oh, Yam is
plural. Yam.
Yam is plural?
Yeah, well, Yamim is plural of Yam.
I'm sorry.
Yam means sea.
Oh, yes. Yam is the sea, like the Dalmatians, of course.
Right. Yeah. Sea. Yamim is sea. In fact, it's interesting that Yam, sea, is associated with the Gentiles just as Eretz, land, is associated with Israelites.
And that's consistent, by the way, to point out to anyone listening. That's he never refers to them as the people of the sea.
People of the land. Yes, people of the land. The Gentiles are the people of the sea.
Right.
Yeah, that's the reason why we know that, for example, the Torahless one, that is misnamed the Antichrist by Christians. He's of the sea. He's a Gentile. But the false prophet of the last days, he's of the land, which means he's a Israelite.
Right.
So if we try now to understand Benjamin, because we've got a series of names here, and that these names only provide merit. They're only useful to us if we take the time to translate the meaning of the name and then review them all in context. This person was a Benjamite. Benjamin. And when you look at Ben-Yamin, and, you know, I'm not claiming here that I'm a scholar, and I'm pretty sure that Scott and you, Kirk, are not Hebrew theologians.
You once called me the smartest person you knew.
I did, and it's true. Which and that's a compliment. Calling you a scholar and theologian would be an insult. So all we've got going here for us is a willingness to closely examine, carefully consider the words, and to deduce meanings based upon what the letters actually reveal. And so when you look at Ben-Yamin, you don't have son of the right hand, because there is no right associated with this,
nor
and no hand associated with this. And right in the sense of correct is tzedak in Hebrew. And it's not, it's nowhere to be found in any of this. So, I would be willing to venture the following translation for Benjamin. Son headed south to the sea of Gentiles. From Ben and Yam, headed south to the sea, headed towards the Gentiles. Now, that's fairly revealing, because what group of people did Paul claim were his exclusive authority?
All the Gentile nations.
Right. He didn't claim any authority over the Israelites.
No.
Nope. Only he ran to the Gentiles. Now, of course, he ran to the Gentiles because the Israelites were familiar with the Torah. And if you're familiar with the Torah, Paul is a laughingstock.
Yeah.
So the only people he could fool were people who were ignorant of the topic he was discussing.
Let me share let me show you all the stuff that I found on Benjamin, which was from all the different sources I have. Mm-hmm. It was scary. You've got, of course, it tells you what all of them say about the son of the right hand called by the father, but that was by his own father, if indeed that was true. But we've got son of my sorrow from Benoe.
You know, we're gonna get to.
You want to get to
that? Yeah, we're gonna definitely get to that. Yeah, boy, we're gonna get to that. But no. You can keep on going. The reason that you came up with "Son of My Sorrows" is because the birth of the boy that his father named Benjamin. Mm-hmm. That's not what Rachel, his mother, named the firstborn of the tribe of Benjamin.
Right.
No, she had quite a discussion, provided extraordinary insights into the nature of the most famous Benjamite who had ever lived, and that would be the self-proclaimed Apostle Shaul, Paul. But yes, a son of my sorrows is a reference to what Rachel, Jacob's wife and the mother of the child that was renamed Benjamin, called him.
Yeah, I did a little research on the tribe, and of course Benjamin, when he's born, other than the little bit of mention they have, he's excluded. Mm-hmm. You know, he really doesn't. They don't say much about him at all. But then a lot about the descendants' characteristics in the tribe, and ultimately down to Paul. They carried a banner with them wherever they went, and it was a sign of a wolf, because that was what they were, the blessing they had, or if you want to call it a blessing, that's what he told them their characteristics would be.
Right.
And then they're almost exterminated by the
While we're speaking of wolf.
Huh? Sure.
Paul only, the self-proclaimed Apostle Paul, he only attempted one prophecy. Only one. And that was what Christians would call the rapture. And they called it the rapture because the rapture is a vicious tearing away. The Greek word is harpazo.
Right.
And harpazo is a verb that describes a wolf ripping something away, tearing it away. And so the one prophecy that Paul actually gives features the wolf, this vicious ripping that Yahweh ascribed to the wolf that was Benjamin prophetically. And when Yahusha is in the Sermon on the Mount, demeaning the individual, the lowly and little one, which is what Paulus means in Latin, who would annul the Torah. He said that this wolf in speaking of this wolf in sheep's clothing, that he would harpazo, attempt to snatch you away from God. So Yahusha uses references to the wolf, the vicious wolf, and tearing away in his prophecy regarding Paul, condemning him. And the only prophecy that Paul actually provided, which, by the way, did not, he got it wrong. He said it was going to happen during his lifetime, so he was wrong. He uses the vicious tearing away of the wolf.
Right.
So this, and most importantly, in that discussion that where Yahusha is presenting this one who would attempt to negate the Torah and therefore estrange those who believe him, keep those who believe him out of heaven, he said that he would be a wolf in sheep's clothing. And so he's going to pretend to be one of the followers of the way, the sheep, dressing up as a sheep, but he's really a wolf, which means he's a Benjamite. So this wolf reference is not a small thing.
No, and when they put it on the banner, they're identifying themselves.
Right.
And there's some reasons for that, perhaps, and some interesting little asides that you dig out. First of all, Benjamin was the only son born in Canaan, so he's a child of Canaanite, and more like a Canaanite than a Yehudim. My reference and my interpretation. He's their territory, of course, was south of Ephraim's, but north of Jerusalem.
Correct.
They had a really narrow little area where you had to, all the roads had to go through there, and they became rather famous for being archers and slingers, and a slingshot, of course, with like David.
Right.
Well,
mm-hmm.
And you usually use
although
that.
David was Yehuda.
Yeah, I know, but I mean that's the for people who are thinking about what a slinger is.
Right.
And they really lived off of the people, robbing the people back and forth coming through there as well. They were almost exterminated by the other 11 tribes, which, in my opinion, would give you a bit of a chip on your shoulder by the time you get to Shaul as the first king. But everybody disliked them. But there was an interesting little note in Genesis 44:20, Benjamin is called a little one. And then you go to Catan.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Now, the reason that little one is important is because not only does the name that Paul chose, because he was born as Shaul, the same name as the king that is going to bring so much harm to the Israelites, whom this prophecy really, the whole Samuel prophecy is about. Shaul, the one of the apostle, but the name that Paul chose, the Roman name, the Latin name that he chose, means lowly and little, and that's particularly relevant because there are a number of prophecies, one by Yahusha during the Sermon on the Mount, where it says that the one that would attempt to annul the Torah and cause any aspect of the Torah to be negated would be called lowly and little, Paulos. And also in this program that we'll do when we return to Proverbs 6, in one of the last statements in Proverbs 6 where Yahweh is just hammering away at his disgust for the religion of Christianity, he ultimately says there'll be no forgiveness for the lowly and little, the one who perpetrated this, the lowly and little one. So, yeah, being called lowly and little is a really, really big deal.
Well, that's the translation, but you go to Catan and get the rest of it, the word, and it's small, young, unimportant, and little. And then you go from that to Keton, which is a derivative. It's a small and insignificant and unworthy.
Where is the does that passage that you found this reference to, Benjamin?
44:20, Barbasheath. And then the two words I went to was Katan, and then Katan is located is Katan, which is from the root Katan. So you've got small, unimportant, young, little. Katan is small and insignificant and unworthy.
Lowly and little.
Mm-hmm, right.
And lowly and little.
Anywhere you go, it's just describing the same little creature, which is Paul. I mean, it's just, I'm beginning to believe that most of the prophecies were very helpful for the people as they lived during the time he wrote them, and it's almost like 7% of the Torah was written for this time.
Yeah.
It's more significant for us than in any group that's ever read the Torah.
Yeah, I think so. That's why I say we have it easier than anybody has ever had it.
Right.
So many times that people say, you know, if I'd only been there during the Exodus with Yahweh, you know, then I would have, you know, been right up there and with him, you know, and if God were to present himself right before me, you know, if he were literally to, you know, to walk in and greet me, then, you know, I'd be right there with you. But, and my response is, no. You know, and people complain, says, well, I can't believe that God would go 2,000 years without a prophet to update his message for the, you know, the progress of human history. And my response is always the same. There is no time in human history where we've had better access to God than we have right at this moment. And part of that is because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so we can get a really high quality text to read. And second is because of the prevalence of marvelous tools. Now those tools are all corrupt; they're all flawed. But when you use them all together, it doesn't matter how dirty and dented the shovel is. You get twenty of them, and you start digging. You're going to find the answer. So there's lots of lexicons and dictionaries. There's also lots of interlinears. And then the letters themselves are so revealing because they convey meaning. And then if you really dig and you look for history and you try to learn by making connections, there is no time where that is easier or more fruitful than it is today.
Right.
And you know, and while the time will come where what we're doing will be punishable by execution, we haven't reached that point. We're at a time, and through a lot of human history, you know, through the period of time that was dominated by the Roman Catholic Church, if you had a copy of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms in your possession, you'd be killed. If you had one in a language other than Latin, the penalty would be torture and then killed. So we are at a time where we can actually read this and discuss it
openly.
And so I agree with you. I don't think there's been any other time where it's been easier for us to make these connections and to learn.
Yeah. Well, you know, from there I went to Ben-O-Ben-On-E.
Okay.
And this is pretty amazing, too, and all the related words to that, which are, you know, it's like going just a nuance slightly different from the root.
Mm-hmm.
Benawi is the son of my sorrow, of course, son of my pain. It also can mean rebel, robber, servant, soldier, stranger. Ben can be builder of family name, conditional, mm-hmm. afflicted, appointed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also related to the word Gerber, which is warrior.
Yeah. And Benoit is the word that you're considering here. This is actually not anything other than a name. It's the name that the only individual that actually knew the boy that was renamed Benjamin, it's what his mother called him the moment he was born.
Right.
And so we'll get into great detail with what did she know that no one else knew?
What was she inspired to know?
Yeah, what was she? I mean, she was clearly inspired to know. Yeah, what did she know that no one else knew?
That's, and why did they put it in the Torah if it wasn't for us to understand?
Correct. So So we will get into considerable detail in all of that. All right, so now there was an individual of Benjamin. The son headed south to the Sea of Gentiles. So, by the way, that was true of the person that this prophecy was written on behalf of. This prophecy was written so that we would understand that a self-proclaimed apostle would arise out of the tribe of Benjamin, whose name would be Shaul, and that he would seek to influence Gentiles. That's the only reason this is provided for us. And his name, so this is going to go through the family tree here. So the first name is Cush, K-Y-S-H, Q-Y, excuse me, Q-Y-S-H, Cush. He is the one who is crooked and lures into a trap, the one who is bent and bowed down from Cush to bait and entice into a snare. You know, the interesting thing about a trap is that the trap never looks like a trap.
No.
Not to the prey. You know, the trap is put on the most walked path of the animal, the most popular path, the favorite path of the animal. And it has whatever the animal likes in it. And it's disguised. And so, yeah, so this person is crooked, luring people into a trap. Twisted. Now, he was the son of Abiel. Abiel is... There's a positive way and a negative way to look at Abiel. And the reference to Canaan with Benjamin and where we're going with this requires us to look at it, the negative side. Do you know who the principal deity was of the Canaanites?
It was the Lord.
Nope. Nope.
I know.
El.
I'm sorry, yeah.
El. Yeah. In fact, it's the only... it's the only civilization where El was actually the name of the god. You know, it's why a lot of people they'll say you ought not write God because God's the name of a fake god. And by the way, I'm not aware of God being the name of a fake god. There's a Gad that's the name of a fake god. There's a Got that's the name of a fake god. But there is no god that is the name of a serving as the name of a false god, and they said, you know, you should write El or Elohim from the Hebrew Eloah, which means mighty one, mighty ones, or almighty. And I said, well, yeah, you know, there is no admonition against using the title. Yahweh uses the title prescribed to himself, but the fact of the matter is that if you're going to use El, do you know that El is, in fact, the name of a pagan god? And not just any pagan god, it's the Canaanite pagan god. And so, yeah, the chief deity of the Canaanites was El.
Yeah, my father is God.
So, yeah, so this would be, my father is El. My father is El, representing the Canaanite deity. Son of Saor, and it's this the TS, which is the signpost, and then R, which is the resh, which is the observant head, wa, which is the tent peg, and then the resh again. It's the one who besieges and binds as an adversary. It's the one prescribing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
The one who distresses and ties up from... So R, to bind and distress, to vex and to show hostility, to harass and to hate. Interesting word because in the list of things that we were told that governments would do and that government leaders would do, would they would take the sons and turn them into soldiers, but they would take the women and turn them into drug makers. And I had shared with you that the term that most English Bibles translate perfumers doesn't mean perfume. It means to mix ointments that would be used as drugs.
Uh-huh.
And I think since our last program, you went back and
I did.
and say, you know, I didn't see that. I'm going to catch him on one of these days that he's going to come up with something that's not going to be
100.
Yeah, so I'm going to do that. And what did you find out?
I found out this the preparation for healing ointment, a salve that rubs to the skin. It's definitely a use of drugs.
Yeah, and the reason that's important is because the basis of Christian and the basis of Christ is from chryso, which is the Greek word for to drug, to be drugged, to apply drugs. As a matter of fact, when Yosha is speaking of Laodicea, and he's talking about their preoccupation with their health care, speaking of the democracies of the latter days, he specifically says that they, Christo, they make and apply a drug, an ointment for the eyes.